From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. United Airlines lost its third bid for $1.1 billion in government loan guarantees this week, a setback for an airline struggling to pull itself out of bankruptcy protection. But United isn't alone in its plight. Delta, US Airways and American Airlines are also struggling to stay aloft financially. In part, their plight is the result of the post-9/11 plunge in air travel. But high costs and stiff and increasing competition from low-cost, no-frills carriers like Southwest, JetBlue and AirTran are also taking the wind out of the big carriers. The airline industry is still undergoing a major transformation thanks largely to deregulation measures instituted more than 25 years ago. Now, with the government's rejection of the United plea, will the big struggling carriers survive the new era? Should they? Tonight on Point, airlines big and small and their battle for America's skies. Should the government bail out United? Should the government bail out any airline when it runs into financial trouble? Why are the big airlines struggling? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. First, we turn to Micheline Maynard, a staff writer for The New York Times who covers the airline industry. She joins us from Pittsburgh. Mickey Maynard, welcome to you.
Thank you, Julian. It's a pleasure.
Mickey, can you firstly describe to us what happened this week with United Airlines in its attempt to secure loan guarantees from the government?
Yes. United Airlines, which is the second biggest American carrier, had applied 2 years ago now for about $1.8 billion in loan guarantees. And just to make it clear to your audience, this isn't federal money. It's a federal guarantee that if United were to default on the loan, the government would step in to make sure that the banks were repaid. This program was set up after the 9/11 attacks. It was a $15 billion program, of which $5 billion was direct cash payments and $10 billion were these loan guarantees. United was the last case before what was called the Air Transportation Stabilization Board. This was actually its third try to get federal assistance. It was turned down once in December 2002, sending it into bankruptcy, and then it was turned down again about 2 weeks ago now, and after that time, the Treasury Department and the Transportation Department kind of stepped in on the board and said, you can have another week, put another application together.
So why does the Air Transportation Stabilization Board keep on saying no to United?
Well, there were three criteria to get loan guarantees. One, of course, was that you would have a good chance of paying them back. Second was that you provided a necessary part of the air transportation system. And the third was basically that you couldn't get loans anywhere else. You were shut out of the credit markets. The board actually never even talked about United's business plan, and there were a lot of analysts who questioned whether that was a sound plan to begin with. But what the board looked at was, did United need a loan to be a necessary part of the transportation system? And they said no. And was United shut out of the credit markets? And the board said, we think you can borrow, so go try and borrow.
And that is what United are now planning to do.
Exactly. United's been in bankruptcy since December 2002, and they had planned to use these loan guarantees as the centerpiece of a $2 billion plan to come out of bankruptcy. They had gotten backing from a couple of banks and then another $400 million on top of that. Now they've got to go out and find at least $2 billion in free money, or available money, excuse me, out there. And that's probably going to prove a pretty difficult task.
But United are also looking to its workforce, are they not, to make cuts?
Pretty much any lender or any investor is going to say you have to cut your costs further, and there's a huge pension liability at United that thus far has not been touched in bankruptcy, and pretty much anyone who would put new money into United is going to demand further cuts. So that's why they're already warning their workers to expect what would be the second round of cuts in their bankruptcy.
And the kind of difficulties facing United, are they reflected in one way or another at Delta, US Airways, American Airlines?
A little bit of it is unique to United because they were actually losing money before the 9/11 attacks. They haven't made a profit since the second quarter of the year 2000. They also used to be employee-owned. The union leaders, in fact, had veto power over the CEO, and that got wiped out in bankruptcy. But what the problems at United, some of them are endemic to Delta, to U.S. Airways, to American, in that these are big carriers that are set up on the old theory that bigger is better, that you want to have hubs of operation with lots of flights to all parts of the country, and that for the convenience of that, passengers will be willing to pay top dollar. Well, pretty much exactly the opposite is happening in the airline industry. In order to be profitable, in order to be nimble, it helps to be a little smaller and a lot leaner than these big giant airlines.
So are you suggesting there's little that the big carriers can do to fight off the challenge of the new low-cost, no-frills carriers?
I think the big carriers are at a real turning point. And there's sort of a parallel with the automobile industry, which I'm also very familiar with. And you have the big Detroit auto companies and then the challengers from overseas. In this case, you have the big airlines and the smaller challengers, although Southwest Airlines is the number six airline. It's actually bigger than U.S. Airways. But these companies have lean operations. They're not all non-union, but they have set up their operations so that they can make a profit at very low fares and very fast turnarounds. I think with the big airlines, they're going to have to look very hard at their operations and say, can we afford, in United's case, it used to serve all 50 states. Can we afford to do that, or do we have to hone in on what can actually make us some money?
So is United going to go under?
I don't think they'll go under. It takes a long time to kill an airline, but we could see the death of 1,000 cuts.
Micheline Maynard, a staff writer for the New York Times, many thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And joining me now from Ithaca, New York, is Alfred Kahn, professor of political economy at Cornell University and author of Lessons from Deregulation, Telecommunications and Airlines. After the crunch, he oversaw deregulation of the airline industry when he was chairman of the Civil Aeronautics Board in the late 70s. Good evening and welcome, Alfred Kahn.
Thank you. Good evening.
Also joining us from Montreal is Paul Dempsey, director of the Institute of Air and Space Law at McGill University and co-author of Airline Deregulation and Laissez-Faire Mythology. He's also a member of the board of Frontier Airlines. Welcome, Paul Dempsey.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening to you, Jack.
Good evening to you and to our guests.
Alfred Kahn, firstly to you, what's gone wrong in your opinion at United?
Well, I don't think anything has gone wrong from the point of view of the public. The purpose of deregulation was to expose the industry to competition, which had been systematically suppressed during the 40 years life of the Civil Aeronautics Board. It was to enable smaller or other carriers to come in. You may remember that Southwest Airlines was forbidden to carry passengers in interstate commerce. So that, in a way, the single most important contribution to the benefit of consumers and the plight of United Airlines was just releasing Southwest Airlines. And as you said, they have, as Ms. Maynard said, they have a very efficient kind of operation. It's a very different kind of operation. They offer a different kind of service. And for the first 20 years, it wasn't clear which method of operation would prove in the end to be successful. It's hard to remember that perhaps 15 years ago, we were afraid that the whole national industry would be dominated by about five big hub-and-spoke carriers. Of course, since then, they've lost major share of the market, but it's been a healthy, competitive phenomenon.
So are you suggesting, then, that the financial difficulties currently faced by United Airlines are, if you like, a triumph for deregulation?
I'm afraid that they are. It's a consequence, but you can't have new intensified competition without people who were previously protected from it, both the companies and their employees, and the wage scales and work practices they developed. It's a question of having an omelet without breaking eggs.
Paul Dempsey, do you share Alfred Kahn's analysis?
Well, not entirely. If you take a look at what has occurred, the financial crisis, and it's about on a 10-year cycle, has grown progressively worse. In the early 1970s, there was a period in which there was a Mideast war, there was recession, there was higher fuel costs, and there was about a $200 million loss in those years. In the early 1980s, we saw again a spike in fuel costs, recession, a loss for the industry as a whole of $1.4 billion. In the 1990 to 94 period, it got 10 times worse than that. It was $13 billion attributed to recession, a spike in fuel costs, a Mideast war, and an act of terrorism over Lockerbie, Scotland. And the most recent period has been three times worse than that. It's a $30 billion loss approximately, contributed to by all of the above circumstances and SARS. And it doesn't. It seems that in every cycle, the financial crisis is worse by a margin that is distressing.
So, Paul Dempsey, you think United Airlines is deserving of a federal government bailout? Do you at the moment?
No, I don't agree with that. I think the problem at United, the particular problem at United, is that the cost differential between itself and the low-cost carriers is greater than the revenue differential that it realizes as a result of offering a premium network product. And as long as that's true, it will be at a competitive disadvantage.
Alfred Kahn, United Airlines should be allowed to sink as part of that national, or rather natural, process resulting from deregulation.
At present, I think that's right. As Paul Dempsey points out, there was a particularly catastrophic effect on the airline industry of 9/11, and I thought it quite proper in those circumstances for the government to help them over what was really a kind of national defense, national security crisis. But that's no longer the case, and I'm not surprised that Paul Dempsey doesn't think they should be bailed out, because he's on the board of Frontier Airlines, which is one of the ones that competes directly with United, and he's competing on the basis of their costs and the services they give. And if United can't compete in those circumstances, then I think it's lamentable, but the public benefits from competition.
Quick response from you, Paul Dempsey, on the basis of you being an interested party.
I certainly don't want to see United disappear, even though I'm on the board of an airline that competes with it out of Denver. And I should, you know, also admit that Frontier did get a loan from the ATSB early on, shortly after the 9/11 catastrophe, but since paid it all back and paid it back early. It was a five-year guaranteed loan. It's all been paid back. But objectively, I would have to agree with Fred Kahn that it's hard to the purpose of this loan program was to deal with the catastrophic impact of that catastrophic event on September the 11th, and it's very difficult to say that the problems that United now faces is attributable to that.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, let me just bring in Jack Beattie and ask him to reflect maybe that if United Airlines goes under, America just doesn't lose an airline.
Well, that's right, and I would never dispute Alfred Kahn, who's the Moses of this field, but just let me offer my own experience. I was a truck driver in the late 60s and early 70s, and it was a pretty good job, Teamsters Union. I owe the gold in my teeth came from the Teamsters Union. And my company, with deregulation, my company, trucking deregulation, was brought out. Another company bought it out, and 20 or 30 truckers just in this local area disappeared. And with them, and what happened? Well, what happened was that non-union carriers came into the picture, and they picked up a lot of that traffic, and that's fine for them. But it meant a decline in the standard of living of the typical truck driver. Now you could say, well, so what? Who cares about him? Well, that used to be a job that people without a heck of a lot of education, but with strong backs and smart, could do. And it's going. And you know, in the 1960s, real incomes in America, real wages, went up about 40%. Since 1973, they've gone up about 8%. 90% of that has been for the top 20%. So it's hard to say that deregulation has produced a better economic climate. Lots of other things involved, too.
Okay.
But deregulation is in there, too, I think, in the lowering of the American standard of living.
Jack Beattie, we'll return to the social and economic consequences of deregulation shortly. Do stay with us, you too, Paul Dempsey and Alfred Kahn. We're talking tonight about the competition in the American airline industry. Has deregulation been a success? You can join the conversation at 1-800 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about growing competition for America's skies between the major carriers and low-cost, no-frills carriers. When you travel, do you consider convenience, price, frequent flyer miles a familiar name? Do you worry what will happen to your city if there's no economic reason to fly into it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Alfred Kahn, Professor of Political Economy at Cornell University and author of Lessons from Deregulation, Telecommunications and Airlines After the Crunch. Also with us, Paul Dempsey, Director of the Institute of Air and Space Law at McGill University and co-author of Airline Deregulation and Laissez-Faire Mythology. Also with us, Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. And Alfred Kahn, if I could just follow up with you, some thoughts raised earlier there by Jack Beattie, some very personal thoughts, but with broader consequences, namely the social and economic consequences of deregulation, and particularly for an airline and the kind of role that that performs in a local community at a hub if it collapses. Your thoughts?
Well, I think Jack Beattie's observations are very useful, but I do think we have to put them in context. The pilots of United and Delta a few years ago, when those companies were already struggling and United losing money, signed contracts giving them something like a 38% wage increase over the next 3 years. Now, obviously, United management and Delta management didn't care for that, but they were threatened with job actions from which United suffered, and it felt it had no alternative. Now, of course, the consequence of competition is going to be to put pressures on those monopoly wages. On the other hand, the Teamsters, they certainly did have a better standard of living. But does that mean that the American people are worse off now? In the case of the American consumers of airline services, the best estimates I know out of Brookings Institution are that deregulation has saved them $20 billion a year. Now, that has been painful, of course, and I'm particularly sensitive to what it does to truckers who are en route. But if you talk even about the labor force, employment in the airline industry has approximately doubled the last time I looked. So you may have had turnarounds and people losing jobs in particular places, but the secret of competition and reducing fares, an enormous increase in the amount of traffic, was increased in efficiency, much more efficient use of aircraft, and enormous benefits to consumers from the discounting that you could see. We see it every day, and we've seen it for the last 20 years. That was not permitted under
Paul Dempsey, is it your opinion that there's been benefits all round, consumers, employees, as a result of deregulation of the airline?
Well, no. But let me say at the outset that I'm not advocating that we re-regulate the industry today. It would be extraordinarily difficult to do that given the heterogeneous cost structure of the companies. But with respect to the Brookings study, I would defy you to find the Brookings study on any website. It has been it's been removed from the Brookings Institution website, and it's been criticized very significantly because it's methodologically flawed. What really has occurred is that real fares measured by yields have fallen at a much slower rate post-deregulation than pre-deregulation.
Oh, I was hoping you'd say that, Paul. Please give me a minute to answer later.
Of course I will. There are undoubtedly consumers who have benefited, particularly leisure travelers, who are trying to go somewhere on vacation. But
Paul Dempsey, could I just bring in Steve, who's calling from Spokane, Washington?
Of
I think
course.
He wants to challenge that particular contention about the benefits to consumers. Stephen, what's your statement?
Hi there. My contention is that it has benefited those who are, I would say, maybe I'll use the word fortunate enough or unfortunate enough, depending on how you look at large cities and metropolitan areas. But those of us that live in remote areas or semi-rural areas of the country did not, and generally speaking, have not benefited from deregulation. We have to fly to major hubs. we pay 2 to 3 times more for a trip to Spokane to Minneapolis than someone flying from San Francisco to Boston, which is far longer, and we'll pay 2 to 3 times those fares for us. So I would say, in part, some have benefited, many have benefited by deregulation, but there are many of us that have not benefited from deregulation.
Afrid Khan, the benefits to the consumer remain patchy.
Well, patchy, yes, but I have nothing to complain about the $20 billion figure, but all you have to do is look at, just use the eyes in your head. Before deregulation, the airlines were strictly limited in the amount of discounting they could engage in. In the last 20 or 25 years, discounting has increased enormously. There's no question about that. And average fares have gone down now with the recent decline, something like 60% in inflation-adjusted terms. Now, there's no question that that has been unequally distributed. It happens that I live in Ithaca, and our service has clearly deteriorated. But the in the last 5 to 10 years, the percentage of mileage that was at discount seats, tickets, was prices, was rose from about 15% to 95%. And the average discount was something like 69 or 70%. Now, how can that be? What's the magic? The magic is that before deregulation, fares were uniform and high. Planes flew around on average 52-53% full for the decade before deregulation. In recent years, planes are filled 70-75%, and indeed it has gone up even since 9/11 to the almost the mid-70s. That's a tremendous amount of leverage. Those discount fares have benefited the airlines because they pay better than empty seats. Okay. They bring in more. So, of course, it's been unequal, and I in Ithaca particularly suffer, except now I can drive to Syracuse and use JetBlue, and I just saved something like 80% of the fare that I would have had to pay out of Ithaca.
Okay, we'll be hearing from JetBlue in a moment, but let's hear first from David. He's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. David, what did you want to say?
Hi, fellows. I'm calling with actually a very pertinent, I think, example of the issue that the prior caller just brought up. Madison, Wisconsin is kind of a unique market. It's it continues to grow and outperform other markets where Madison's got about 250,000 people in the county that it exists in. Just yesterday, as a matter of fact, I flew from Madison to Washington, D.C. on Northwest Airlines, paid $388 for a ticket that I bought about 10 hours before the flight left. A colleague of mine flying from Minneapolis had to fly on United through Chicago, or excuse me, American through Chicago to Washington National, because the fare on Northwest was $1,390.
Gosh.
My options out of Madison are always Minneapolis or Detroit. If I would have taken the flight from Madison, Minneapolis, then out to D.C., on the exact same plane she was going to be on, my fare would have been $388.
Paul Dempsey, some very specific disparities there being addressed by David. Your response?
Well, there's enormous pricing discrimination in air transportation. That's absolutely certain. I do want to respond, though, to one thing that Fred Kahn said, and he said the discount was 60-70% off the full fare. I want to point out that the full fare has increased at a level that far exceeds inflation.
Absolutely.
By any measure. And so the people who are paying that full unrestricted fare are the people who are cross-subsidizing the air transportation for leisure travelers. Now, that's good for people who want to take vacations, but, you know, what we want is an economy that serves business. We want an industry that serves the broader economic needs of the country and not just the tourist sector. And what we've done is we've penalized American business because they're the people who really cannot have the travel flexibility to buy their tickets ahead of time and to stay over Saturday nights. And the inability to arbitrage tickets, puts them at a disadvantage, particularly small businesses. And it's not so bad when you're talking about the Fortune 500, but when you're talking about the small company trying to compete, it's a significant tax.
Jack Beattie, let me bring you back in. And from what you've heard up until now, are you any more convinced about the benefits of deregulation of the airlines, particularly with all those callers and their complaints?
Well, it's a mixed picture, but you can't argue with $20 billion a year in the aggregate. What worries me, though, is the problem I raised earlier, that this deregulation in many fields has coincided with the fall in real family incomes. Now, I don't say it caused it, but I don't think you can argue that that $20 billion somehow went into higher incomes for families, and that's what bothers me. You know, after World War II, we did pretty well in the 50s and 60s with our regulated industries, at least judging by the growth in wages, and that hasn't been the case since. And I know in the long run this will all shuffle out, but, you know, Keynes had the word on that. In the long run, we're all dead.
Okay.
But there is no $20 billion annual savings. All of that study was predicated on a hypothesis of what the world would have been like had we continued economic regulation, and there are too many variables to make that kind of prediction.
Paul Dempsey, I'd like to bring into the conversation now David Neeleman, Chairman and Chief Executive of JetBlue Airways and a former executive of Southwest Airlines. In 1984, he founded a low-cost carrier called Morrisair, which was sold to Southwest. Welcome, David Neeleman. Where do you believe that you are making a go of it where the big carriers aren't?
Well, thanks for having me on, and it's great to listen to Alfred Kahn and Paul and all of you who, you know, have obviously been around a lot longer than we have, or I have. And by the way, Alfred, I was with your father-in-law, I mean your son-in-law, I should say.
I understand.
At the NASDAQ on Tuesday with Mickey.
We'll meet sometime.
Okay.
Yeah, we will.
David Neeleman, why is JetBlue making a go of it?
Well, I think we've figured out a way to build a better mousetrap, and we've been able to combine good wages for our people with lots of upside. I resent the fact that when people talk that we build our company on the backs of our people, and, you know, I'll defy you to, you know, put the wages, our wages alongside of, you know, pretty much any other airline, and if you add on the upside that they have from profit sharing and from the other programs that we have, stock purchase and 401k and all that kind of stuff, I think we're, you know, getting pretty close to the top tier. So we've taken in building the better mousetrap, have created a model which we've got really low fares by combining low cost, by combining technology with very efficient people and great service. And, people can now fly on a better quality product. They can do it for less money, and traveling is less of a hassle. They like it more, and they come back and they fly again.
What would you do if you were running United Airlines at the moment?
Well, I think I've been asked this question a lot, and I said I'd resign. I mean, it's obviously, you know, I'm not a person that likes to run companies that I didn't, you know, create. You know, it's a very difficult challenge, and you know, I don't know. I don't really have an answer for it. I guess I would. One thing I would do, and, you know, this will come across as sounding really self-serving, but I think one of the big problems that these big airlines have gotten themselves in over the years, and they very effectively eliminated competition for lots of years after deregulation. They figured out a way to yield manage and really squeeze and add capacity, and really something like 80 airlines went out of business. And so they just became accustomed to doing business that way, thinking that if they just added flights and matched fares, they could drive someone out of the market. Well, that's a new day has come, and you have competitors that, you know, not only have lower costs, but they also have better products than they do. And, you know, you see some of this old capacity dumping, and, you know, every time we add a flight, someone else adds a flight on top of us, and they lower the fares. And, you know, I think if United would just go back to their core and say, look, where are our strengths? Where are our hubs, our international flights that are profitable? Let's do that. Let's quit trying to run people out of business. You know, let's not worry about market share. Let's worry about it internationally. Let's worry about it in our hubs. But let's pull back some of this nonsensical flying that we've used to try and run people. Let's figure out where our strengths are, where our weaknesses are, and focus on our strengths.
David Neeleman, I mean, airline executives like to say that theirs is a cyclical business, and in the next stage of that cycle, what you should now be doing is expanding to be the biggest, regardless of the cost, betting the good times will last forever and eventually make you profitable. Are you going down that road?
Who, us?
Yeah.
Well, we're profitable now.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, we're expanding. We think we've got a better model. We think we've figured out a way to have the best product in the industry and do it for the lowest cost. We've had the highest margins in the industry for quite a long time now, and we're growing and we're expanding, and you know, we've been successful, and you know, not without tremendous pricing pressure and competitive reaction. Probably some of the most competitive things that have ever been tried in this industry have been tried against us. You know, American did a little thing this first quarter where they offered people flying on routes where we flew out of Boston and New York to California and Florida a free ticket worldwide if they'd just come and fly them twice over a period of 4 months. Which I don't think's ever been done before against an airline, and we survived, and we had double-digit margins, and so no.
That's cutthroat competition from the big carriers. But would you welcome other no-frills carriers in the same field?
Well, sure. You know, and we could go compete against Southwest if we wanted to. It just doesn't make a lot of sense when there's a lot of routes that we can fly where they've already stimulated a lot of traffic. And you know, why would we go flying those routes when there's many other routes that we can fly where we can stimulate traffic? I mean, our model is dependent on the ability for us. And I was just at the office looking at some routes that we were going to, you know, look at flying with our new 190s, our 100-seat airplanes. And you've got markets that are a distance from JFK Buffalo, where we get about $65 each way, that today are getting $200 each way. The walk-up fare is $800 for an hour and 10-minute flight, and so you know we're going to go in there and we're going to drop the fare by to a third, and there's 292 people in that market flying today, and we're going to take it to about 900 a day or 1,000 a day, and you can't tell me that all those people traveling and staying in hotels and going in restaurants and you know going to shows and isn't having a tremendous economic benefit. On our economy, plus the fact that our people are well paid.
But very briefly, is there a role for the major carriers as well, United, Delta, US Airways, and American Airlines, serving what might be described as the more unprofitable routes?
Well, no, I think there is a role for them. You know, we're never going to be a hub-and-spoke carrier. We're never going to get you from Burlington to Spokane, Washington in one stop. Just not what we do. But, you know, United can do that, and American can do that, and Delta can do that. And you know, I guess the question is, you know, do you need, you know, six network carriers? You know, I don't know the answer to that question. And do you need, I don't even know how many hubs we have in the country. You call it, you know, 18 or 20 hubs. You know, the answer may be, you know, yeah, we need six network carriers, but, you know, there's a lot of unprofitable hubs out there that need to go away. And then you'll end up with the fortress hubs,
okay.
You know, the ones in Chicago or Dallas or wherever.
David Neeleman, Chairman and Chief Executive of JetBlue Airways and a former executive of Southwest Airlines. Many thanks for being with us this hour. Do stay with us, Alfred Kahn, Paul Dempsey, Jack Beattie. We're talking tonight about growing competition in the airline industry. Why do you choose the airlines you fly on? Do you choose the cheapest seat or a familiar name? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about growing competition in the American airline industry. Should the government bail out United? Should the government bail out any airline when it runs into financial trouble? Why are the big airlines struggling? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Alfred Kahn, professor of political economy at Cornell University and author of Lessons from Deregulation, Telecommunications and Airlines After the Crunch. Also with us, Paul Dempsey, director of the Institute of Air and Space Law at McGill University and co-author of Airline Deregulation and Laissez-Faire Mythology. Also with us, Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. And let's hear straight from Dave, calling from Jellicoe in Tennessee. David?
Yeah, I'm here.
What would you like to say?
Well, you touched an interesting point that hit home for me earlier when you were talking about truck drivers. I was a truck driver in the late 70s, right before deregulation, and I'm driving one right now as we speak. In fact, I pulled over to get in on this conversation. Back then, a new truck was $32,000. Fuel was 30 cents, 35 cents, somewhere in there. And as an owner-operator, I was making 85 to 88 cents a mile. After deregulation, when I sold my trucks in 2002, the new truck was $96,000. Fuel was $1.50, and I was still only making 88 cents a mile. And it seemed after deregulation that every time there was a consensus to be made or a cut to be made, it was passed down to the working class, while the administrative branch of the industry seemed to be soaking up more and more profits. I just can't help but think that this will be the same thing that's going to go on here. Their answer now, of course, if we don't like it, is to bring the Mexican drivers up because they'll drive a lot cheaper, and I just can't help but think that's going to happen in the same industry. So it, in my opinion, can't do anything but promote worse service, more accidents, poorer quality equipment, while the executives seem to make more and more money.
Alfred Kahn, let's just keep it airline-specific, and could it be that deregulation has, in fact, not brought the promised benefits to consumers and has forced down the kind of wages that employees earn?
Well, let's see if we can come down to some points upon which I think we can agree.
Yeah.
The first is that with average fares down something like 55 to 60% in real terms, that has clearly been a major contributor to improved standard of living of Americans. And it has reached way down into middle and low-income people precisely because of the availability of discount fares. That I think we all have to agree with. The second is that, yes, competition has differential effects, and there's no question that the wages, particularly ones that have been above competitive levels, most obviously pilots, machinists, but also Teamsters, that they may be driven down by competition, and that therefore it's, the benefits are differential. But the benefits to the public at large are undeniable. Whether it's $20 billion or not, it seems to be unimportant, except that was a very serious estimate. Number two, though, what we are witnessing is a real uncertainty in what the future holds about what kind of operation is going to emerge.
Okay, Alfred Kahn, if we could just probably develop that in a little while. But let's hear from George. He's calling from Madison, Wisconsin, and he wants to chip in on that same question of pay, but from a slightly different angle. George, what did you want to say?
Well, first of all, I wanted to explain that I hold a Bachelor of Science degree in economics, and I'm an FAA-certified aircraft and power plant mechanic.
Okay.
And
are you currently working for any organization?
No, because they're quite restrictive where I am.
Mm-hmm.
You either work for one or you don't work.
Okay.
Now, the only point I wish to make is that we have to, that your both of your guests are missing part of the equation, and that the equation must include the fact that during the Reagan administration and William Casey, that by keeping the price of crude down, they bankrupted Russia, but in the process. I also hold a dislocated oil workers certificate from the state of Colorado, and it put me out of work.
Okay, George, in relation, though, specifically to the airline industry, what was your comment?
The point is that the keeping of crude down below its economic value allowed the airlines to get fat, to pay unusually high wages. Not that they're not necessarily unjustified, but it allowed them to do it.
Okay. Let's just get the reaction of Paul Dempsey to that.
Well, that's a new theory, one I've not heard before.
But, I mean, the whole question of major carriers paying their employees too much.
Yeah, one of the things that occurred under deregulation was the elimination of something called the Mutual Aid Pact, which allowed airlines to cross-subsidize their losses if they suffered a strike. And in the airline industry, because it is so heavily regulated on the safety side, and because fixed costs bulk so high as a proportion of fully allocated costs, it's nearly impossible for a major airline to take a prolonged strike because of the financial cost of the money going out the door. And as a consequence of that, labor sits in a position whereby it has been able, in the post-deregulation era in particular, to extract from the major airlines, which had been able, I should add, to suppress competition through most of that period through predatory practices, force them to pay wages which are not sustainable in the long term, and certainly not sustainable in a more highly competitive environment that has emerged in the last 10 years.
Let's get a reaction from Jack Beattie to that. The major carriers have been forced to pay their workers' salaries larger than maybe they deserve or are competitive.
Well, I don't know the facts. I certainly concede that he does. May I return to something George brought up, which I think sort of makes the case, or at least suggests a case for bailing out airlines, and that is that U.S. foreign policy, to a peculiar degree, and U.S. public policy generally, impinges upon this industry. Obviously, fuel prices and terrorism and so on. But these are they're not just risks of doing business. They are actions or reactions to things our government has done that has endangered this industry and that periodically does endanger it. And I'm just saying that, you know, it seems to me that if Chrysler could go and get a bailout and be a successful company, Lee Iacocca is a cultural hero to this day, and paid back the government, it seems to me you can make a stronger case that airlines are more necessary to the economy, and that the government policy, foreign policy in particular, impinges on them to the degree that the government has a certain responsibility to them.
Well, remember, the government, though, has made a significant contribution, $5 billion in direct grants shortly after September the 11th. More recently, about $2 billion plus to cover the security costs that the industry has suffered. And then on top of that, a $10 billion loan guarantee program. So the government has responded in the way you're suggesting that it should.
Okay, Alfred Kahn, you were getting onto it just a short while ago, the future. And do you think that airlines like United, American, Continental, Delta will survive?
I suspect, as somebody suggested, that there probably is not room for, in the new competitive atmosphere, for 7 or 8 major hub-and-spoke carriers. They were able to grow, and as I pointed out previously, we thought that they were going to come, the top 3, 4, 5 were going to dominate the entire industry. One major reason they were able to grow was that they offered a peculiarly good service.
Yeah.
I could leave a dinky town like Ithaca in the morning, and I could get anywhere in the United States by noon via a hub. But they have tremendous fixed costs of maintaining that convenient scheduling, let alone the high labor costs they've had imposed on them. And so they've been able to cover those only by charging very low rates for the people who will fill their planes and progressively higher rates to the people whose demand was inelastic.
But could I just ask you more specifically, though? I mean, do you see them maybe being relegated to a smaller corner of the market, such as the international routes, where they can still make money? Briefly.
Right. Oh, I think that's highly likely, as somebody suggested. But you have people like David Neeleman coming in. These people are public benefactors. But it does mean that there is not the same room. The major carriers are not going to be able to have that highly differentiated wage structure, which has until now made them dominant in the industry.
Okay.
How much it's going to balance, we don't know.
Alfred Kahn, many thanks for being with us. Alfred Kahn, Professor of Political Economy at Cornell University. My thanks to you also, Paul Dempsey, Director of the Institute of Air and Space Law at McGill University and co-author of Airline Deregulation, a Laissez-Faire Mythology. And thanks to you too, Jack Beattie, On Point New Zealandist and Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. And I should point out, we contacted United Airlines with a request for a representative from the company to participate in this program. A spokesman for the airline said it's declining to comment on this matter. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Cassini spacecraft sends greetings from Saturn. This is On Point. 6.5 years and 2.2 billion miles after its launch, Cassini last night became the first spacecraft to enter Saturn's orbit, and hours later began transmitting its first images of the planet's majestic rings back to Earth. Cheers erupted at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory after Cassini completed its perilous maneuver into Saturn's orbit. Scientists believe that the 6 rock from the Sun, its rings, and its roughly 30 moons hold the secret to the origin of the solar system. Trina Ray is a science planning engineer with the Cassini mission. Here she describes the breathtaking images of Saturn's rings that Cassini transmitted earlier today.
The images are spectacular. They were coming down this morning. There were a whole group of people here at JPL. We were sitting in one of the conference rooms at 5 in the morning. We'd been up most of the night, and we all just grabbed a couple of hours of sleep, and we came in, and the images hit the ground, and they're spectacular. A couple of highlights, we had a terrific image of the F ring. The F ring is a small little ring that's sort of on the outside of the ring system, and it's got these two little moons that shepherd the ring along and keep it nice and tight and sort of this separate little ring. And it just is magnificent. It looks, you know, there's waves and kinks and braids and wispy stuff coming off toward, it's phenomenal. The particles of the rings of Saturn, they're little sort of dusty, icy, rocky pieces, a lot of ice, and they range anywhere from little tiny grains of sand upwards to boulders and, you know, very large, you know, pickup trucks. And each one of them orbits Saturn separately, and so they all orbit in their own little racetrack, so to speak. So the ones on the inside orbit faster than the ones on the outside, and you get these really terrifically interesting phenomena when one of the neighboring moons goes by, causing the sort of this little compression of ring particles. So the particles get close together and far apart and close together and far apart in this very specific wave pattern that's called density waves. And the A ring is littered with density waves that are caused by all of these other moons. And when the images came in, it was just, you know, oh my gosh, there's the A ring and there's density waves and there's more density waves. And I mean, everything was just spectacular. Some of the stuff we'd never seen before because we have not had resolution like we do with the Cassini cameras. So there were small-scale structure that nobody's ever seen before. Nobody knows what it means. If you want to understand how the solar system formed, you really need to understand how particles in disks interact with each other because it's quite complex. And how a particularly big particle can sweep up material or how it can eject material from the system. So the formation of the solar system is quite analogous to the processes that are going on in Saturn's ring system. In Saturn's ring system, we have gaps with little moons in them that are clearing it out. We have other places where we have processes that are forcing material to go all together. So it's really understanding the processes of disks and the formation of the solar system was in the disk, and the formation of Saturn's rings is obviously a disk. So that's the analogy between Saturn's rings and the solar system. Then there's no other ring system in the solar system that is as spectacular as Saturn's. You can just tell that obviously with your eyes. But in addition, every kind of ring that we see at Jupiter or Neptune or Uranus, we see an identical kind of ring at Saturn. So Saturn has every type of ring process or disk process that we know of.
Trina Ray is a science planning engineer for the Cassini mission based at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.